from the heartland of America and the gateway to the West. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Now, next hour, what happens when a small group of men placed within the military, government, and intelligence services begin believing in some very strange things? You won't believe what happens. And also, the infiltration of the Bohemian Grove with guest John Ronson. Alex Jones, by the way, who also infiltrated the Bohemian Grove, will join us in the latter part of the third hour. So get ready for this one. Well, this was expected. Flood water in New Orleans is now contaminated with E. coli bacteria. An official in the mayor's office now declined to be identified, but apparently the failures of the levee system after Hurricane Katrina's onslaught left about 80% of the city flooded with water up to 20 feet deep. Water that became a toxic mix of chemicals, garbage, corpses, and human waste. E. coli comes from human and animal waste and can be found in untreated sewage. Drinking water contaminated with E. coli can lead to serious illnesses and death if not properly treated. Authorities have warned that it will take weeks to drain the water covering much of the city. Now, as the water level in much of New Orleans begins to slowly recede, officials are preparing to deal with thousands of dead bodies, bodies floating in contaminated water, hidden in damaged homes, and even piled together in the freezer of the city's convention center. They call it Disaster Mortuary Operational Response Team, DMORT. They are saying expect up to 40,000 bodies. President George W. Bush, by the way, says he will lead an investigation into how the Hurricane Katrina disaster was handled. He says, I'm not going to find out right away. It could take time, but I want to get to the bottom of it. I want to find out about the slow response. The U.S. Senate is also to hold two inquiries of its own into this disaster, which hit the Gulf Coast in New Orleans. Officials in New Orleans have urged its last residents to leave the swamp city, saying it is now uninhabitable. And FEMA's government's disasters chief waited until hours after Hurricane Katrina had already struck the Gulf Coast before asking his boss to dispatch 1,000 Homeland Security employees to the region and gave them 2 days to arrive. Michael Brown, the director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, sought the approval from Homeland Security's Secretary Michael Chertoff roughly 5 hours after Katrina made landfall on August 29th. Brown said that among duties of those employees was to convey a positive image about the government's response for victims. Before then, FEMA had positioned smaller rescue and communication teams across the Gulf Coast, but officials acknowledged that the first department-wide appeal for help came only as the storm raged. Brown's memo to Chertoff described Katrina as this near catastrophic event, but otherwise lacked any urgent language. The memo politely ended, "Thank you for your consideration in helping us meet our responsibilities." And apparently the head of FEMA was in charge of a private sector horse show. That was his last job. He was fired from it. Before joining FEMA as the deputy director in 2001, Mike Brown, the Republican Party activist, had no significant experience that would have qualified him for the position. But he got the job through an old college friend who at the time was heading up FEMA. Brown, formerly an estates and family lawyer, this week made several public admissions, including interviews, where he suggested FEMA was unaware of the misery and desperation of the refugees stranded at the New Orleans Convention Center. Before joining the Bush administration in 2001, Brown spent 11 years as the commissioner of judges and stewards for the International Arabian Horse Association, which is a breeders and horse show organization based in Colorado. And now he's heading up the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Neil Armstrong, the first man to go on the moon, says a manned mission to Mars will not happen for at least 20 years. But he said the effort might be easier than what it took to send him to the moon in 1969. He said a couple things have to be worked out first, and that includes protecting shields from harmful space radiation before a manned flight to the red planet can be accomplished. He said it will certainly be 20 years or more before it happens. Neil Armstrong is 75 years old. seldom appears at public functions or grants interviews. Fields of volcanic cones discovered at the North Pole of Mars suggest that the red planet could be very active. You'll see this complete story on the hot stories under coasttocoastam.com. The cones, seen in images from Europe's Mars Express probe, have no blemishes from impact craters, and this suggests the volcanoes erupted very recently and that the site could have ongoing volcanism. It's an amazing story on Mars. And a man in Moscow, even a freight train rumbling over his head, failed to spoil his sleep. He fell asleep on the tracks. The train pulled him, but he's okay. Alive. Amazing story there. There have been a series of earthquakes all up and down California's coast, and I mean a lot of them. What does this mean? Is something big on the horizon? In a moment, our guest, Jim Berkland, he'll tell us what he thinks is going on Coast to Coast AM. Geologist Jim Berkland was suspended from a California government geology job when he made a prediction that a major quake would occur during the 1989 World Series in the Oakland Bay Area. It hit, and the government told him, "Don't make any more predictions, Jim." Well, now that he's retired, he publicly states quake windows. Mr. Berkland uses tidal flooding tables and also disappearance of pets. And he's very, very accurate, our guest right here on Coast to Coast. Jim, I wanted to bring you in because I've been getting a lot of calls and emails from concerned people all along California's coasts because of what they say is a tremendous amount of quakes that have been going on for some time now. Is that the case, and what does that mean, Jim?
Well, it's partly the case, but I first wanted to talk about Katrina, if I can just have a moment.
Well, just get into this first, if you would, okay. Then we'll get to Katrina.
Well, the big area where the quakes are occurring is in Southern California, where I've called for a 6+ this year based on the record rainfall. Back in May in my newsletter, I said, based on the past near record rainfall, 37.25 inches in Los Angeles, when they normally get about 14.
Right.
And the upcoming extreme tides, I've been warning about a strong summer quake in Southern California. We got a taste of it last month with the 5.2 in the Tehachapi Mountains on April 16th. Based on my own extension of a 1978 article by several USC scientists, there's been a clear pattern of extreme rainfall being followed by strong earthquakes of 6+ magnitude in Southern California. Now, around Salton Sea on the southeast side where the geothermal wells are, right close to the geothermal wells and close to the Sani Bono Nature Preserve, there's mm-hmm. a little peak called Obsidian Butte. And it's very high heat flow, and right on the San Andreas Fault, and an area where swarms of quakes have been fairly common in the past and frequently are topped off with a 6 to 7 magnitude quake. Well, just a few days ago, we had a 5.1, and that was on top of about 8 quakes of 4 to 5 magnitude and dozens of quakes in the 3 magnitude range. So this is one of the largest swarms in the history of Southern California.
Is this a prelude, Jim, to something big?
Well, as I mentioned, this often happens. You end up with a 6 to 7. Certainly not I don't expect an 8 or a 9. This is the southern active zone of the San Andreas, where there's fault creep and where a lot of moderate quakes occur and tend to relieve the strain of a buildup so it doesn't get an 8 or a 9 magnitude quake. To the north of here, around Palmdale, that's where the fault is locked. And that's where very infrequent, very large earthquakes do occur, and one is overdue up there too. But I really feel confident there will be many, many clues, mostly from animals and water levels, before any great earthquake occurs.
All right, does this series of quakes concern you at all, Jim?
Yes, but out in the desert, we can handle those 6s and even 7s without too much problem. It would be less of a problem than a 6 right in downtown Los Angeles. But that I'm not calling for. In fact, the missing pets in the L.A. area, in the L.A. Times, yeah. They often get up to like 30 or 40 missing dog ads prior to large earthquakes. They've been down around 4, 6, and they hit a high of 10 3 days ago, up from 4 on the 1st of September. So that probably represents the distant quakes 100 miles away in the Salton Sea area of up to 5 magnitude.
All right. I have a feeling we're going to have to check back with you on that one, Jim, because, yeah, as you said, the series, I'm looking at a picture from the USGS, and like you have just said, I've never seen so many dots representing earthquakes.
This happens
ever.
Yeah, I've just on my website, I have listed the past ones that have occurred, the past swarms, and the 75 was a classic swarm, and the swarm of quakes is a series of usually small to moderate quakes without a clear main shock. And then occasionally there is a main shock. And that would then convert the previous quakes to foreshocks and the following quakes to aftershocks. But you have to have a clear main shock, usually about a magnitude stronger than the nearest,
sure,
the closest to it.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. Now let's talk about Katrina for a moment.
Yeah. Now, this is for sure the greatest natural disaster in the history of the United States. I sat up all night watching the Weather Channel and seeing this coming and waiting for the relief people to come in. And I could not believe my eyes to see thousands of people on rooftops and waiting for help that didn't come. And I wrote this little thing here, which I just gave to the Lions Club. Our little Lions Club just voted $1,500 for Katrina relief, and our little church on Sunday voted $1,000. And I think
everything helps, Jim.
This is what we need to do. It's from the common man. We can't really rely on big government. Now, I think you can appreciate this that I wrote and I put on the website. Around the world, disaster strikes, and we are quick to act. Our ready thumbs go in the dike. Rely upon that as fact. For flood or fire or storm and slide, our people have a plan. With expertise and sense of pride, we help our fellow man. But now we wonder what went wrong with hurricanes this year. 2005 finds us less strong. Katrina captured fear. The bureaucratic bungling made communication lag. Our brightest plans began to fade, and doubts began to nag. How can we let a city drown and people starve and die? Our citizens have been let down while leaders sit and cry. The world was watching this disgrace, our worst in history, and questioned whether class and race saves him or her or me.
Well done, Jim.
And so that's, I mean, a lot of people share that feeling. And it's no excuse for what has happened here.
I'm afraid that even if we have an earthquake of the magnitude that could cause some serious problems, we're not prepared for this. We're not ready for this, are we?
No, and in 1906... we were lied to for about 80 years. In 1979, I discovered that 5,000 to 10,000 people died in San Francisco, not a few hundred that we were told in all the textbooks and all the experts. And when I tried to publish a paper on it in the early 1980s, I was told, Jim, we have the official numbers. I said, which do you like, the 277 or the 315 or the 452 or the 478? All sound very official and precise, and they were all total BS. So I said, it's 5,000 to 10,000 is more like it. Well, this disaster will top that, I think, as our greatest national disaster. We lost over 8,000 in the Galveston hurricane of 1900.
Well, you know, they've been estimating 10,000, but, I mean, the story I just had where the morticians are saying get ready for a possibility of 40,000.
That's what I just heard, and that is how many were needless. I mean, where people are told to evacuate and they have no means to evacuate. And then
let me ask you something.
They have no provisions in the shelter.
If a person decides they're going to ride this out on their own, you know, they're given all the information, but they don't want to leave, which wasn't necessarily the case here in New Orleans. But I guess you can't fault government for that, right? They can't just go and kidnap the person or grab them and
they have to
take
provide
them
a means for evacuation, and they had all the school buses that got drowned there.
But I'm saying most of the people in New Orleans probably would have left had they been given the means to escape,
yes,
don't you?
I think so. There would be some, like, in Mount St. Helens, where they just held on like old Harry Truman there. You can hardly blame them because they've had so many warnings in the past, and the city has done quite well because it's veered off or it's been a little less strong than they anticipated. And so people say, oh, it's too much trouble to evacuate, and we don't have any place to go.
You know what concerns me, though, Jim? Here we had on December 26th the tsunami, which we talked about,
sure,
where 300,000 people died.
Yeah.
Now we have this one where countless thousands have died. We don't have that exact number yet. We may never get the exact number. How often are we going to be getting to the point where we have these tremendous amounts of deaths where, you know, you may be back on here in 6 months saying, well, this earthquake now is the biggest tragedy we've ever had. How often are these things going to occur?
See, like I just wrote in my newsletter, the main difference between a hurricane and an earthquake, both are predictable, but most people can see the signs of an oncoming hurricane more clearly than they can the signs of an earthquake unless they really know what to look for. But when it's all over, you know, after an earthquake, where you can find your stuff. And that's a little ironic, but I don't see any earthquake in the United States causing 10,000 deaths. Our buildings, you know, we're not building out of adobe and unreinforced brick.
Even if a 6, 7, or 8 hit Los Angeles, for example, you don't think we'd have that amount of fatalities?
I really don't. Remember, it's falling things that kill people, not just the earthquake, no matter how hard it shakes. But there's certainly precedents. In 1933, I was 3 years old. Our family lived in Long Beach, California.
Mm-hmm.
They moved us out in the early January, and on March 10th, on the day of the eclipse of the moon, a 6.3 hit just off the coast of Long Beach. It did tremendous damage to dozens of schools, and Governor Olson quickly called for a committee, and within 2 weeks he had their evaluation, and they said if that quake had occurred not at 5:45 in the evening, but about 2 o'clock in the afternoon when the schools were in full session, we would have lost between 10,000 and 30,000 school kids. Now that is what got the state legislature off their duffs, and they passed the legislation the fastest in history. By the end of that month, March of 33, they had adopted the Field Act, which said schools are something special, and we have to build them stronger than normal buildings. Well, for years and years, school districts said we can't afford to upgrade our buildings. They could build the new ones up to code, but the older buildings, students continued to live in them. And when I became county geologist in Santa Clara County in 1973, I was surprised to read in the newspaper 3 years later, San Jose, California became the largest city in California where all of its schools met the Field Act code, 1933 to 1976, before they met the Field Act code. So I think our disaster planning, it's great to have plans, but you have to carry them out. And that was the big failing here. Everybody was waiting for somebody else to do something.
Well, that's true.
And you read about the individuals, the school kid that got that school bus and loaded up people and took them off to Houston.
Hey, that kid, Jim, was a hero. Hey, thanks. And Jim's website, of course, I'm going to spell it for you, SYZYGYJob.com. It's linked up with coasttocoastam.com. And by the way, we're also watching a tropical depression, which could strengthen into a tropical storm, Ophelia, by Wednesday, and that could hit the Florida coast. So they're keeping an eye on that one. When does it all stop? In a moment, we're going to be talking with two experts who can help us out a little bit about this situation now in New Orleans with this E. coli bacteria situation in the water. They are from the Metropolitan St. Louis Sewer District. They've got a lot of experience. They were around here in 1993 during the horrible flood that I witnessed. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. The After Dark newsletter is available to you. You get one a month, but we'd like to give you a free CD. It's called Perfect Possession, It's an interview that Art did with the late Father Malachi Martin some time ago. It is a scary CD, but you know what? It is perfect to possess. The Perfect Possession CD available when you call 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505. Or you can also go online, order after dark, subscribe or renew. You get the free CD, coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. In 1993, here in St. Louis, I had the opportunity to witness the big flood of 1993. And let me tell you something, it was something, though it is dwarfed by what happened in New Orleans. I also had the opportunity to watch the Metropolitan St. Louis Sewer District in action, how they handled that kind of a situation, that kind of flooding situation. And now with everything that's going on in New Orleans, especially now with this E. coli bacteria situation, I thought it'd be very important to bring in two experts on the subject to talk about just what the city of New Orleans is going to do in this kind of a situation. We have two guests for you for the rest of this hour. Jeff Thierman is the executive director of the Metropolitan St. Louis Sewer District. Here we call it MSD. He has 20 years experience with MSD. His prior career experience includes 4 years with Illinois' Environmental Protection Agency. He's got a Bachelor of Science degree in Civil Engineering, a Master of Science in Civil Engineering, a registered professional engineer in the state of Missouri. During that 1993 flood, Jeff was the assistant director of wastewater operations in charge of MSD's Bissell Point Wastewater Treatment Plant. In that role, Jeff was very intimately involved in MSD's response to that flood, overseeing the protection of the Midwest's largest wastewater treatment plant. He's our guest this half hour. Jeff, how are you? And thank you for coming on at this short notice.
I'm fine. It's good to be here.
And Randy Heyman is the general counsel for the Metropolitan Sewer District as well, MSD. His experience includes 12 years of experience in the area of civil litigation as a trial attorney, former assistant attorney general for the state of Missouri. He's got a Bachelor of Arts degree in political science from the University of Michigan, a Juris Doctorate from Georgetown University's Law Center, member of the Bars of Missouri, U.S. District Courts of Eastern and Western Missouri, and the U.S. Supreme Court. He is with us as well. Hi, Randy. How are you?
George, doing fine. Good to hear your voice.
Good, good. Likewise. In this particular case, Jeff, with what's happening in New Orleans, the E. coli bacteria, was that unexpected?
No, I wouldn't say it is. Anytime you have a flood situation like's been experienced there, water quality suffers. There's sewage that's in the water. There's a lot of other organic material in the water. And so it leads to bad water quality situations and the potential for waterborne disease.
Let's talk a little bit about what happened in 1993 here in St. Louis, because there are some similarities, though, again, not to the extent of what New Orleans is going through. What kind of problems did you face here in the St. Louis area, Jeff, when the flooding started?
Well, 93 was a big event for us, but you're absolutely right. It pales by comparison to the devastation we're seeing in New Orleans. In 1993, in the summer, St. Louis experienced about 90 days of severe flooding, and at its peak, a major levee failed, which caused the flooding of one of our sewage treatment plants. So we felt a sort of a mini version of what the sewage officials are going to be dealing with down in New Orleans over the coming weeks and months. In that summer, a medium-sized treatment plant by U.S. standards went under. We had staff there at that treatment plant 24/7 trying to keep it operational during this flood. The plant was in essence an island in a sea of flood water, and eventually the levee that protected that plant failed and the plant went under. Our people got out, and for the next 30 days MSD fought its way back to having an operational treatment plant. all told, we spent about $20 million restoring that plant to operations, but not without a lot of heartache and a lot of hard work by our employees to get it to happen.
Now, how many treatment plants does MSD have, Jeff?
We presently operate 8 plants, and they range from very small plants that serve several subdivisions to large facilities that handle large portions of our city.
So you lost then during that flood, I would guess then you could say 1/8 of our capability, right?
That's correct. And the way sewage treatment plants are built in this country and around the world is that there's no backup plant waiting in case one gets flooded. So when a treatment plant is flooded out or becomes unoperational for some reason, there isn't any treatment going on. And the river that receives what's normally a treated flow typically would get flow that isn't treated, or raw sewage. So.
Now, in New Orleans, I would assume they've lost all their capabilities. Is that correct?
Well, I'm not familiar enough to know precisely. New Orleans does have 2 treatment plants, but I don't know whether they both have become damaged. Now, it appears that there's no power, at least there hasn't been power. So, and wastewater treatment is a business that is very energy intensive. So you have to have power to make things work. They have a number of pumping stations, and according to the reports I've seen, a number of those stations are coming back online, which is allowing for the pumping to start to dewater the city. So it appears that they're starting to get the pumping going that it takes to get the water out of the city. If their treatment plants have been flooded, they've got a long way to go before they'll actually be doing complete treatment again. That's a long process of fixing the mechanical and electrical equipment that makes sewage treatment work.
Now, E. coli, of course, Jeff, can be pretty serious. A death if not properly treated. What can they do about that? I mean, can you dump chlorine in Lake Pontchartrain? Can you dump chlorine everywhere? Because now I'm told that they're probably going to have to dump this contaminated water into the Mississippi and into, Lake Pontchartrain. That could create all kinds of environmental problems.
Yeah, they probably don't have any choice but to pump the city. Well, they have to pump the city down, and the only place they have to pump it is into the waterways there. That may cause problems. I think the health officials and the environmental officials in the area are going to have to do a good job of seeing that problems don't occur. Disinfecting a lake is, as a practical matter, awfully difficult. But I think time will tell. They really are right now without a whole lot of choice. They're going to have to get the water down the city so that they can restore the infrastructure that's been lost.
Randy, this sounds like it could be just a legal nightmare if all these atrocities continue happening to New Orleans. If they try to rebuild, for example, if their 2 treatment plants are down, how long does it take to get contracts ready and everything else generally if you have to do something like that?
Well, you know, George, you hit the nail on the head. The dynamics of what we're looking at is very unique. We have not seen this in America. And what I'm thinking is that even in a perfect situation, if you didn't have a flood, it may take you 90 days to go through a RFP process to select someone for a contract and then to negotiate the contract. Now, granted, we're dealing with an emergency situation. I think what's going to happen is you're going to have probably the federal or state government coming in, maybe sole sourcing who the contracts are going to, and they will be executed in a very expeditious fashion, I believe.
And in terms of the funding, the money, would that come from the federal government, Randy, as opposed to state and local means?
Well, that has yet to be said. I mean, that's the story, that's the chapter that hasn't been written yet. I think there is going to be a lot of money that's going to come in from the federal government. But at the end of the day, I think you're going to find out that a lot of money and a lot of responsibility is still going to be at the foot of the states. It's going to be their responsibility to help to bring everything back into flow. You know, Jeff made some very good points, and one thing that we have to understand, a lot of what we're looking at is easier said than done. When we talk about the pumps, for example, and they say, well, if we get them operating. Well, the problem we have is that if we even if we get them operating, we have to be able to, they have to be able to keep them clean. Imagine all of the junk that is floating around now in New Orleans that's going to be sucked up into the pumps. They have to keep those clean, and it may very well be they'll be able to get them to work, and then all of a sudden they'll find themselves clogged. Also, too, there's some dynamics engineering-wise, and I think Jeff can talk about this, that you can't really get the system to work. You can't test the system without having people there and having a certain amount of a load that goes through the system.
Oh, okay, and if no one has moved back, then you really can't test it.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, the folks there with the Water and Sewage Board in New Orleans, I'm sure, know how to get their pumps going again and know how to protect them during operations. But the point about having a load is a good one. When you initially start up the plant, you'll be able to test equipment and get things mechanically and electrically operating. But you do need those plants are designed to have a population of hundreds of thousands of people, and without that population there, they're really not going to work very well. They may be able to operate well enough for the population that still remains, but that'll yet to be seen. Well, I'm sure they're going to have to work their way through those startup issues. If the plants have been flooded, though, we're talking a while before that's going to be the primary issue.
And you really can't have people come back there then if you don't have a proper sewage waste disposal program, right?
That's right. The infrastructure has to be restored. They've done exactly the right thing in evacuating. They have an impossible situation if you have a large population there. But they have an infrastructure and a water, electric, and wastewater infrastructure that's got a lot of hurdles ahead of it before the population can come back.
Now, in theory, Jeff, assuming their individual sewers aren't clogged, for example, let's say coming from someone's house, if they were to discharge their toilets, for example, I mean, what would happen to the waste? Would it go through the sewer system somewhere or go nowhere?
Well, not knowing their system specifically, I don't know that I can answer it. In our system, there are relief points that can be utilized if the plant's out of commission. Now, they're not utilized normally. They're not allowed to be. But if you have a situation where you're faced with difficult choices of transporting it to a river untreated or having it back up into neighborhoods and flood homes, then you choose the lesser of the two evils. And in this case, or in the case of 93 flood, when our plant went underwater and was non-operational for 30 days, that's exactly what happened. The sewer system functioned, mm-hmm. Pump stations worked, the treatment plant was offline, and we discharged into one of the riverways.
The bodies that are everywhere out there, does that create some kind of a problem as well? The E. coli, of course, coming from human and animal waste, but what about the bodies that are floating around? What do they do about that?
Well, my sense is that the health officials in New Orleans are going to be doing what they can to find the remains and treat them with the respect that they deserve, and that goes hand in hand with the health aspects of the whole situation. So I don't think those are incompatible things. As soon as the water can be dealt with, then they'll be dealing with the remains of those that lost their lives in this catastrophe.
Jeff, let's use St. Louis as an example just so people get an understanding of how this system works, how a sewer district works and functions. All the sewage generally goes where, and then what happens to it, and then where's it sent on to?
Well, everyone's home is typically connected to the sewers. Sewage flows from the home or from businesses. If the way the land lies lends it to just flow by gravity, you don't have pumping stations. Where you need to pump to overcome a hill or a high point, then typically you have pumping stations. There's a number of them in New Orleans. There's quite a few here in St. Louis as well. Ultimately, the flow gets to a treatment plant. treatment plants are usually located near the river that would be receiving the treated water. And wastewater treatment plants are biological machines. We use the bacteria that are present in the wastewater to break down the pollutants and remove them. It takes time for that biological machine to get started up and to work properly. And so when you have a situation like our flood, where a plant was flooded, lost its power, not only do you have to repair the electrical and mechanical systems, but you also then have to restart the biological machine, which can take weeks or up to a month. And throughout the country, that biological kind of treatment is what's typically employed. It works really well. It mimics nature, and only it's able to do treatment in a much more confined space and faster.
And then, of course, go ahead, Jeff.
Well, so what you have is an engineering problem from a mechanical electrical sense, and a lot of this equipment, when it went under, was operating. It gets contaminated in the operation underwater. You have motors that are destroyed, bearings that seize. One of the big problems in a catastrophe the size of New Orleans could be trying to get spare parts. Typically, you'll store parts on hand for what you think your normal use would be, but you certainly wouldn't store spare parts on hand for all of your infrastructure if it had to be repaired. So that may be what comes in months ahead, is difficulty finding spare parts for the sheer number of pumps or motors that have been damaged.
Jeff, overall in the United States, how long has a sewer system infrastructure been in place where we have these our homes and we can do what we have to do and it goes into a treatment plant? Is that a 50-year-old process? Is it been around for 100 years? How long has it been here?
Well, sewers have been around a long time. The first sewers installed in St. Louis were put in the ground during the Lincoln administration. So that's been over 150 years. Treatment plants are more recent. The oldest treatment plants in the country were built in the early 1900s, but the majority of treatment plants really were built in the 60s and 70s. So you're talking about a 40 or 50-year horizon. And I think that brings up really a good point about infrastructure. Katrina has pointed out how fragile our infrastructure is. In one week, New Orleans lost virtually everything in terms of infrastructure. Now, it's hard to imagine that happening, but it's happened here. And I think all of us tend to take sewer, water, transportation, electric for granted. It's the way we live in modern times. But it is also a major infrastructure that's been put in place over decades, and you have to maintain it. You have to invest in it to make sure it's there for the future.
Well, and you're so right, Jeff. We have taken it for granted because, you know, people don't realize it's out there. I've watched some successful bond issues, for example, in St. Louis pass, thank God, for the sewer district. But people don't really realize that if that system goes, they got to go.
Well, because it's a catastrophe.
Absolutely.
Out of sight, out of mind. But as Jeff said, you know, we have, in some parts of St. Louis, wooden sewers. As he said, some of them go back all the way to Lincoln. And what has happened across the country and what happened in New Orleans is a tragedy. But at the same time, there is a systematic aging of our systems across the entire country. But since it's out of sight, it's out of mind.
So true. What seems to be the most, in just in a couple lines here, Jeff, because we're done with out of time, what's the most progressive city in the world with a sewer system? Any out there?
I think most cities are grappling with the same sets of problems. Large needs, growing populations, and limited funding. So,
okay. Well, let me tell you, with your knowledge, if anybody in New Orleans needs any help, they should call on you, Jeff. Thanks so much. Appreciate you being on the program. You too, Randy Heyman, as well. That's a situation with infrastructure, which is an important facet of this entire situation down in New Orleans, because unless that's fixed, you don't have a city. You can't go back. And I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.